From the Center for History and New Media at George Mason University, this is Digital Campus, featuring Tom Scheinfeld, Mills Kelly, Amanda French, and Dan Cohen.
Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country. Fear itself.
This is Digital Campus, episode 87, recorded June 1st, 2012. You guys sound fantastic.
Welcome back to Digital Campus. I'm Tom Scheinfeld from foundhistory.org, and I've got here with me today the regulars, Dan Cohen. Hey, Dan.
How you doing, Tom?
Good. And Dan's at dancohen.org. Amanda French. Hi, Amanda.
Hi, Tom.
And Amanda can be found at amandafrench.net. And Mills Kelly. Hi, Mills.
Hey, Tom. I'm coming to you today from the Witness Protection Program. I'm in a secure and undisclosed location as a result of all of the haters out there.
Most hated man in academia? Is that?
Kelly haters have sent me into hiding.
Yeah. You sound like you're in a bunker somewhere. Well, say hello to Dick Cheney for us.
Yeah, he's sleeping in this morning.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And it's good to be back with you. I missed the last show with all of you guys. It was a great show. It was nice. I was saying to someone, it was nice to be able to listen to the podcast for a change, because I hate listening to myself. So. Since I wasn't on, I got to listen to the show, and that was great. And we're very lucky to have back with us again after a hiatus of probably a year, Steve Ramsey. Hey, Steve.
Hey, Tom. Good to be back. I when you guys don't call and say, you know, come on the program, I start to worry that I'm not, you know, I'm no longer welcome.
Yeah, you're not in the in crowd. You're not at the cool kids table. No,
like it,
don't.
Like it must have been something nice. It must have been something I said on the last show.
Yeah, talk about hate mail.
Exactly.
Yeah. No, but it's great to have you back. And give us a URL to follow, Steve.
Well, I am. My blog and all of my content is at lens.unl.edu. Lens is L-E-N-Z.
Great. And everybody should check that out. And we're going to have a little bit more to say later in the show about your blog and some things you've been doing there and some things that some cues that some other people have taken from your blog, some other people in the digital humanities community. But let's jump in to a couple of news stories. Actually, it's been kind of a busy couple of weeks.
Yes, and appropriately, I managed to crash that service.
the first thing I think, you know, I don't think we've mentioned on the show, or at least we haven't talked at any length about it, is probably the big tech story of the year. I don't think there's going to be anything bigger, and that's the Facebook IPO. Only our listeners who live with Mills and Dick Cheney in the secure bunker will not have heard about the Facebook IPO. And
Facebook's gone public. What?
People will know that it has had it's been sort of a mixed result for Facebook. You know, certainly a lot of people made an awful lot of money, but not maybe as much money as they expected. And there's some talk that this is the since Facebook's share price has actually, I think, gone down considerably, and I think it remains down since the initial public offering. And some people are saying that this is the end of the social media bubble. What do people think about that?
You know, I watched this really closely, and I thought it was all good news. It was good news for the markets, good news for the tech industry, and the, you know, it's useful to review, like, you know, what happens in when a company goes public like this. So you have a big company, a big private company like Facebook. They need to raise money because they want to expand, and so they contract with with an investment, with a large investment bank that becomes the underwriter of the stock. And they do a couple things. They, first of all, navigate the very complicated legal and regulatory framework for filing an IPO. But their main task is to come up with a value for that company. So they look at assets and revenues and patent holdings and anything else to try to come up with a number for how much Facebook is worth. And so so you have these very highly paid financial analysts who are looking at this stuff. And the first thing to say about them is that when they get that number right, they make a lot of money. And when they get that number wrong, they make a lot of money. You know, there's just like there's no right. I mean, so it's all kind of a game. So the number they came up with, and I'm just recalling this, but I think the number was $104 billion. They decided that Facebook Corporation is worth $104 billion.
Right, that sounds about right.
And so then, you know, you have to think to yourself, it's like, first of all, is Facebook a valuable company? Well obviously Facebook is a valuable company. Even if they do nothing but what they're doing, they are a valuable company. But $104 billion makes it a more valuable company than Disney Corporation. $104 billion makes it a more valuable company than Kraft Foods, right? I mean, right. And so they're hoping for what's called a pop, right? They're hoping for first day demand on the stock to drive the price way up. So they buy it at 38 and sell it at 75. And of course, this is the story this was what happened during the tech bubble. So what happened instead is that people looked at that number, largely institutional investors, but also, you know, individual investors as well, en masse looked at that number and said, no way. There's no way. That's not worth that much. That value is incorrect. And it's been tanking ever since. It's now down. It's hovering around 27 this morning, $27 a share. And I just felt I watched this whole thing and I felt like you have a stock with no first day pop. It's like an attack of rationality in the market. Right. It's not pets.com. It's not the tech bubble. Everyone seems to have evaluated this stock in this company in a very kind of sober way and said, it's worth a lot. It's not worth that. And I thought, you know, because all of the irrational exuberance of the tech bubble and the tech crash, you know, was sort of bad for everybody. Right. When values are crazily high and crazily low, it has terrible effects on the tech industry and terrible effects on we who feed off the tech industry. And so I just thought I watched the IPO and I've been watching it since, and I thought, you know, this is just good news. What I saw the market doing was like, no, you know, it's yeah, it's worth a lot of money. It's not worth what they said, but it's worth. And so I thought, like, wow, this is good. This is very positive.
It worked this time. Yeah,
it
yeah.
worked this time. I was very surprised. I mean, this is a very kind of wonky subject. I was actually very surprised that Facebook didn't do a Dutch auction, which is what Google did when they had their IPO. And the thing about a Dutch auction like that is that it sort of removes any possibility of a pop, you know. And I thought, you know, that too seemed to me like a sober move on the part of Google,
right?
You know, after the tech bubble, to say, you know what, we're just going to try to get an accurate number on what the company is worth, and then we're going to go forward. Morgan Stanley, you know, I think they were playing games. I think they were doing their old tricks. They're like, let's get a pop, let's make, you know, all this kind of stuff, and they got and the market said, yeah, we're not in the mood for that anymore.
Well, if I could just add my sort of jerky two cents to this. Did anybody else did people I'm sure notice Mark Zuckerberg got married the day after this IPO? People saw that, and I can't help but think that his poor wife now, because the price has gone down, and if she divorces him, she gets nothing, because she only gets the difference between what Facebook was worth when they got married and what it's worth now. She doesn't get the it's not community property if it was earned before the marriage. And so I don't know. I just thought that was a very telling. this is complete gossip,
like,
of course.
She stuck with him for a while.
Yeah, I mean, this is, I just thought that was, I can't imagine a more, I can't imagine why you would marry that guy.
Well, and of course, another bit of scandal accompanying the Facebook IPO was one of the co-founders renouncing his U.S. citizenship and skipping off to Singapore to avoid the tax burden of the having to the taxes in this situation are really interesting. Mark Zuckerberg, of course, was $16 billion richer or something like. I mean, he sold a crazy amount of stock on the first day, and like Mark Zuckerberg, significant source of revenue for the state of California.
He could turn the state around.
That kind of tax is like not, you know, I mean, that is a serious amount of money, you know, so you had that, and it's like, well, that's good for California. But then you had this other guy step off, and, you know, and a lot of people were, I mean, this sounds like a very kind of, right wing, critique, but I think people were within their rights to say, you know, look, you know, this guy came to this country. He got fabulously wealthy. He was educated here, the whole bit. And then, you know, I that was not a good thing for market capitalism, I think.
No. Well,
I wouldn't want to state that quite as extremely as some of the critics did, but I did feel a sort of like, you know what, that's kind of bad pool.
Well, I mean, I think what we're all really interested in is Facebook gossip, but I suppose we should turn to some stories about educational technology and digital.
Actually, on the Facebook thing, just to circle it back to academia, I do kind of wonder what Facebook going public kind of means for, you know, all the college students who are still, you know, pretty addicted to Facebook. And, you know, I would assume under capitalist rules that now Facebook is going to have to do some things to, quote unquote, monetize these folks. I had this odd experience of going to a carnival over the weekend. And I checked the Twitter back channel for the carnival, and which had its own hashtag. And it was filled with teenagers, which really surprised me because I hadn't seen a lot of teenagers on Twitter. I assume they all hung out on Facebook. But, you know, there was this Pew report this week that said that now there's like this surge of growth in Twitter.
You remember the move to Twitter from among my son's friends.
Really? Yeah.
Well, you remember MySpace? Anyone remember MySpace?
Sure, yeah. You know,
vaguely.
I still have a MySpace page.
I think Rupert Murdoch remembers it.
There was a really interesting moment when MySpace, you know, and I could see it in my students, you know, where, of course, MySpace was the dominant social network for a long time. And they, you know, there was this moment where MySpace is for high school kids. You know, Facebook is for college kids. And so people would get into college, close down their MySpace account. And, you know, it got associated with a certain, like, whoa, well, now I'm a college student now, so I'm going to get off. I'm not going to do the kid stuff anymore. I'm going to get off. I'm going to get off MySpace and go on to the mature and sober Facebook sort of thing. You know, it's like that kind of shift where something becomes suddenly cool or uncool. I mean, this could happen. 18 to 24 year olds could decide tomorrow that Facebook is, yeah, my mom's there.
Right.
They're gone. They're
just
gone.
Not cool.
I mean, that's just the, and I mean, this is not news to anybody at Facebook, I'm sure. I think they probably spend all their time trying to think, you know, what are we going to do when that happens? Because anyone thinks that Facebook has a lock on social networking has been living in Mills Bunker, because there's just no way. I mean, you could lose it all tomorrow. Twitter is the same way. I mean, we could all, you know, next week something's better and we all shift. That's, you know, because it takes nothing to shift. There's no friction there. You just, you know, whatever.
Oh, that's not true. There's tons of friction in shifting, which is that, you know, if all your friends are in one place, you all have to move more or less at the same time. I mean, I take your point about moving from high school to college, you know, and at that point you actually do lose some old friends and acquire some new friends. But if you're, you know, without a major life change, I actually think it's kind of hard to just switch from one social network to another.
Well, right. I guess I would say that it's probably, you know, I actually think it's probably less likely to happen on Twitter because Twitter is the kind of more mature, you know, it's Twitter's, you know, Twitter's core usership seems to me to be people who traffic in information, you know, journalists, academics.
I have to disagree with you again there, Tom. I think that that was once true. I think Dan citing the Pew report is really interesting. But actually, I just went to a talk by somebody who works at Bitly. One of the points she made, she was showing some really fascinating stuff, which she prefaced with the memorable statement, you know, one of the things we've learned is that my network is not your network. And she was just, you know, showing a number of graphs and a number of specific examples showing how very different, you know, people's experience of the same network is, you know. And so my experience of Twitter is definitely as a professional network. But there's lots and lots of people using Twitter in a very, very, shall we say, unprofessional way.
Yes, that, I think that's absolutely. I think that's absolutely true. I guess the point I was trying to make was, it would be hard for all of us to all of a sudden decide to change our network. It seems to me that younger people, it's a lot easier. Like they, you know, fads and trends stream through young people much more easily, you know, than they do through older people. You know, I'm still wearing the same outfit I was wearing in, you know, 2000. You know, that's not true of 15 and 16 year olds.
You really should change your clothes.
Now that you've brought that up, Tom.
Yeah, you should.
I've been meaning to talk to you about that.
Yeah, I know. I'll put you in touch with my wife. She thinks so too.
Who do you think asked us to talk to you?
Is this turning into an intervention? Moving on, we saw some. Moving on to a subject that our listeners will be well familiar with, the Google Books settlement is back in the news. I know. We got to talk about it, though.
I think this is an important development this week.
I actually do think this is important. We're recording today on Friday, the 1st of June. Yesterday evening, the judge in the case sent down an opinion certifying the Authors Guild as a class. So one of the things that Google was trying to argue since the settlement fell apart was that the Authors Guild didn't have standing because they weren't a class. The judge decided that they do, and so they now can move forward with the lawsuit. Dan, you've been following this very closely. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, well, it came as something of a surprise to me because I had talked to some legal experts who thought that this line of attack from Google might actually work. In other words, that I think a lot of authors, including myself, who've written books, do not feel like they're in the same class as Stephen King or John Grisham. And, the 9,000, mid to A-level class of authors who, write books for a living. We have different interests. We have very divergent interests. Like I'm interested in my ideas spreading more than I am in getting royalty payments. So from what I had heard, there was a good chance that the judge would not certify the Authors Guild as having standing in the case. The judge actually, and I guess this is in some ways very commonsensical, said, look, if Google took the approach that all authors were the same by just going out and tipping up the bookshelf into the scanning machine, if they took that attitude, why shouldn't I take that attitude and say, look, Google thought all the authors were basically the same and just did a mass scanning job on all of them. So why shouldn't the Authors Guild represent everyone?
I saw that point and I was like, touche. I was like,
it was a good point. And, it gets worse. If you look at the language carefully, it's just a disaster for Google. It really is. And by extension, maybe it's a disaster for HathiTrust and some of the nonprofits and universities who are relying on Google scanning to win this case because – Judge Chin uses some very, very strong language about Google just improperly, he actually uses the word unauthorized in their copying and sweeping and undiscriminating scanning. I mean, the language in this ruling, which is just a kind of step on the way to the main case, looks really bad for Google. And, I think the only positive thing that can come out of it is it looks like we're now going to trial and there'll be a decision based on the original argument back to 2005, incredibly. Now we're going to see if this works out.
Gosh, that's 7 years now. We will continue to watch this for our audience. Stay tuned for more. More from the legal desk, we saw recently, not quite as recently as yesterday, but recently, a ruling come down in the Georgia State e-reserve case. Amanda, you've been following this. What did the judge say in that case?
This happened a couple weeks ago, just after we recorded the last Digital Campus, so it's slightly old news now, but basically, it was about 95% of the cases that the publishers cited as having been infringing by Georgia State's putting copies of these in their course reserve system. About 95% of those cases, the judge ruled, were indeed fair use. One interesting aspect of it was that in many cases, the presses couldn't actually prove that they owned the rights to the books that they were, suing over, which was, was amazing because you really do have, it's such a paper trail for each individual work. But you would think that, like, before they went to court with certain examples, they would have made sure that they had examples they had good paperwork for, but such was not the case. It was five of the 99 infringements alleged by the publishers actually violated the plaintiff's copyrights. Win for e-reserve systems, bit of a loss for publishers wanting to control use of those e-reserve systems. One of the slightly more mixed results from it, could be good, could be bad, very specific guideline for use. For other universities doing the same kind of thing. And, this was a 350-page decision. There's a number of things in there, but this was a 10% of any particular work would be regarded as fair use, or one chapter from like a multi-chapter, multi-authored book. And that was, I found that a little bit interesting just because often people had been using 20% as a guideline in my experience. So it's a little bit stricter. But nice to have that precedent on the books to where, like, okay, if you use 10% of something, you're going to be fine. So on the whole, really good result.
Although, one of the things that irritates me most about the whole fair use discussion is these 10% and some, one chapter of a multi-chapter book. And what irritates me about it is that it comes from a writer that the American Publishers Association put onto that legislation. But it is not itself a legal construct, right? There's nothing in the Copyright Act or in the fair use provision that says anything about percentages or anything. It has this fourfold test for fair use. And what I was really hoping was that this case wouldn't just renegotiate those numbers. Because those numbers are – I mean, I don't want the numbers to be there at all. I want a court to look at the situation and apply the fourfold test, right, and not have this kind of like – because it seems to be quasi-legal.
Yeah, I'd agree with some of that, Steve, in the sense that it's – currently there is no actual number in the law. But in practice, a lot of people have actually wanted that number. An analogy I use sometimes is that, look, the annoying thing about copyright is that you don't even know what the speed limit is. It's not even posted. It'd be one thing, to know that the speed limit is 55 and to gripe about that because you want to go 65. But mostly, copyright has been in this situation of, well, if you broke the law, we'll tell you afterward if someone sues you. A lot of times it's just really hard to be certain. So I agree that it's, it's a little annoying to have these numbers in there, particularly when they're lower than you'd like, and particularly since the law itself, as currently constituted, doesn't, you know, sort of specifically on purpose, doesn't give numbers like this. But I think it's ultimately a fairly good thing for practice that people can at least be sure of whether or not they're likely to be breaking the law.
Well, it seems like on balance, on balance, probably a good thing, but still within the realm of annoying copyright law. Something that seems like not so good news is the announcement that the University of Missouri Press would be closing, and that the university has withdrawn its subsidy for the press, and that means that the press is going to have to shut down after 50 years or more of publishing. It's a sad day for university presses, I think. Mills, you've been predicting these closings for some years now, slower than you initially thought, but still part of a pattern.
Yeah, you know, I'm sorry for the employees of the press. I'm sorry to see another press go. I think this is really inevitable. I think we're going to end up with a dozen or so university presses that survive because they can cross over into the revenue generating market successfully, and they have enough of a name behind them, and the universities are rich enough that they can afford to have a jewel in the crown of a press. But I think what really we're going to see is an acceleration of some sort of an e-press model, and I think we're just going to see a lot more of that, and I think we're going to see more and more presses close over the next couple of years. And I think because Missouri has been a great press, and so when presses like that close, then the cost-cutting people on campuses around the country are going to say, if Missouri's going to close theirs, why do we have to keep pouring money down the hole of ours?
Well, that's the news. But let's, on that kind of depressing note, I think I want to turn to something that maybe a little bit less in the news, but something that I think is a trend that I think we've all been watching, and which I think several of us on this show have joined, and that's the trend towards minimalist design on academic blogs, primarily text websites in general. I think we've seen and it's certainly tied to the rise of mobile devices and iPads and tablets, distraction-free reading, something we've covered a lot actually in the past on the podcast, distraction-free reading and writing. It seems to have, that trend has seems to have accelerated. And Steve, you moved to you've always had a bit of a minimalist blog, but you've moved to a very minimalist blog in the recent past. Can you tell us a little bit more about how you made the decision and what it is you chose to do with your blog?
Part of it was me trying to live out the advice I give my programming students, which is to write the dumbest thing that could possibly work. I'm always telling my students, like, they want to go off and build cathedral, and it's like, you know what, you should definitely build that cathedral, but you should start with the dumbest thing that could possibly work. And I started to look at WordPress. And I don't doubt for a second that for many use cases, this is absolutely the ideal tool. But for me, I have a lot of content. It's mostly text content. I need an efficient way to get it up there. And so I switched to Jekyll, which is a static site generator, a very, very simple system, very, very, very sort of easy to use. It doesn't have a backing database, any of that sort of stuff. But I also think there's another thing enabling, because I do think this shift toward sort of textual minimalism on the web. We've had several major modulations in web design over the last 15, 20 years that has taken us miraculously from like GeoCities to now, and I think that one of the big revolutionary components here is typography, by which I mean not just the font, but the tracking and leading and kerning and all of that. When you get that right, the design, the rest of the design will flow from it. And I think, for most of the history of the web, and most of the history of the history of computers, we haven't had type, we haven't had fonts that really rival paper, you know, text fonts. And I think we're now, you know, we have now, I mean, this didn't happen last month. It's been happening for a few years. But the display types and fonts that we have now on the web are so excellent. There was a time in computing when everything had to be sans serif because that was the only thing you could read. And now the screens have gotten better, the resolutions have gotten better. And so, you know, I don't know if that's really driving the minimalism, but it feels like a component of it that you can really do things with type now that I think certainly 10 years ago, but I think even 5 years ago you couldn't do.
You know, I think not coincidentally with the kind of rebirth of Apple, this is typography is something that Steve Jobs has always been very, very interested in, very concerned about. And I think, you know, the reemergence as Apple as maybe the most important player in the tech world has reinforced some of that trend towards towards importance of typography. Dan, you've relaunched your website in the last couple of weeks too, the same direction.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I, like Steve, I was sort of looking to just focus on the text, and I agree completely that things like Google Fonts or Typekit or Font Squirrel, you know, well done fonts that look really good at different sizes. And so I was just sort of looking across the web and seeing a lot of examples of this, Instapaper and readability. In fact, most of the time I do a hotkey change of most websites to invoke readability to just strip out all the ads and all the junk so that I can read an article on, let's say, the New York Times website. And you know, I just got to a point where I wanted my blog to be like that without anyone having to do anything. And so I think there's been this movement. And I consider it to be kind of part of the maturity of the web to say, you know, that there's a lot of distraction on the web. I think there's a kind of revelation that there's a lot more than the blink tag that makes the modern web bad. And unreadable. So I think we're going to see more and more of this. And, you know, I think particularly, as you said, Tom, with Apple surging forward and providing devices that have Retina displays and that. You know, I think this stripping down, this minimalism, I think we're going to see more of it. And I just wanted to get out in front a little bit.
Yeah, I think there's a, you know, we're all fans of ebooks and things like that, but frankly, I don't want ebooks if it means jettisoning the entire history of book design in the process. You know, there's something sad about the Kindle where you have a book and, you know, you open it up on the Kindle and it's whatever sans serif monstrosity, right? I mean, and so it's like part of this for me is sort of romantic. Like the types get better and the screens get better and we can actually go back to the sort of, you know, the kind of classical beauty of real typography and real book design.
Yeah.
I think that's absolutely part of it. You know, I encourage listeners to look at Jeffrey Zeldman's post on this. He's redesigned his blog. He's a kind of thought leader in the web design community, and he's redesigned his blog to be, you know, better typography, bigger type, single column, designed for reading, which is really what the blog is designed. That's what you want users to do, and that's what we should be enabling. And one point he makes, I think that's you know, very telling. Dan, you mentioned Instapaper and readability. Point he makes is that, you know, the very existence of those products means something on the web is broken, that we need,
right.
You know, we need, right. a program, an app to make the web readable. The web should be readable natively. Hopefully that's true. I hope this trend also signals a kind of similar trend, maybe an associated trend, a parallel trend towards HTML5 mobile applications. That, you know, one of the reasons I think for the rise of the app on mobile devices as opposed to mobile optimized websites is because, you know, the web is so cluttered. But as I think, you know, we move to these cleaner designs on our websites, they're going to look better natively on mobile devices. And maybe we won't need a dancohen.org app. We'll just be able to, you know, read dancohen.org in the browser on the iPad or iPhone.
Yeah, I mean, and I spent a lot of time in redoing my blog just getting the CSS for mobile devices to, you know, look better without using, you know, a readability type app. And it's hard to do. I mean, I think what's up next is, and I think Automattic, the company behind WordPress and WordPress.com, you know, they've already announced that in the next version of WordPress, they'll have that kind of baked in so that people won't have to fuss with the style.css file to, you know, make everything look good on an iPad or an iPhone or an Android device or whatever's going to come next. Everything will just be reshaped and resized as needed.
What I wonder, too, if this isn't kind of a harbinger death of RSS. Because the thing about RSS is that it, you know, it did that mm-hmm. same thing that readability does, right? Is it pretty much, you know, most RSS readers would take that content and strip out everything that wasn't text. And, you know, I certainly hope RSS is not dying, but people keep saying it is.
I'm actually hoping that we're witnessing the end of the Web 2.0 design where I have a light blue background with a rainbow and a cloud that says, build stuff, period, better, period. You know, this kind of, I mean, you know what I mean? Like this kind of vague. I mean, this was a real fad that's been going on, and I really dearly hope that's ending.
Well, with that, I guess we'll say goodbye for another week. Steve, you know, thank you very much for being on the podcast again. We got to get you on again sooner.
It was my pleasure. It's great talking to you guys. Really, really fabulous.
Yeah, thank you very
Good
much.
Talk and, to you, Steve.
And for Dan and Amanda and Mills, I'm Tom Scheinfeld, and we'll see you all again on another edition of Digital Campus.
The only thing we have to fear is fear itself.
Please visit us online at digitalcampus.tv, where you can join in the discussion and let us know about stories and issues you would like us to cover on future episodes. Mike O'Malley wrote our theme music.
Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country. Fear itself.
So we're all here.
Yes, we're all here.
Amazing. On the first try. I shouldn't jinx this in Skype world.
You guys sound fantastic.
No, you sound good, Steve.
We should just...
No, I know. I think
this could be the whole podcast. Press record. No. Steve, you sound so good.
Man.
You're like an auditory wonderland of...
You know what? We jinxed it. I just lost Mills.